The Guardian.
Hello, this is Science Weekly. I'm Alok Jha. On the show this week...
Certainly, the opposition to GM and nuclear is irrational and is not, has no scientific basis and is basically prejudice. And it requires you to behave like a climate skeptic or denier on GM and nuclear.
Okay, well, the reason why our scene-setting, upselling and upbeat Science Weekly theme music has gone to ground there a little bit is because our extended and controversial interview with Mark Lynas, who you heard there, on his new book, The God Species, is, well, not upbeat, it's confrontational, uncompromising stuff. It might inspire you, it might drive you to fury. Either way, the normally ice-cool producer Jason was incensed enough to ban the music. But stay tuned, because this week's show is not just about the work of Mark Lynas.
If we point our antennas in the right direction, we can listen to those radio waves and we can frequency shift them down into the audible range, and we can then hear them as sound clips.
Yes, it's that time of year when the Royal Society makes great science lots of fun at their summer science exhibition. We went along for a good rummage around. This is Science Weekly from The Guardian. Okay, well, the music has stopped. That's because we've got Mark Lynas in the studio. Now, Mark is best known for his prize-winning book, 6 Degrees. That explored in terrifying detail what life on the planet would be like as global warming pushed towards its upper limit. Mark is a former leading green activist, but has now created controversy and a few enemies amongst his fellow environmentalists. Why? Well, he's come out in support of both nuclear energy and genetically modified crops, two areas that are off-limits to traditional greens. Lynas explains his conversion in his latest book, The God Species. Here, he outlines 9 key planetary systems that keep the Earth a functional and productive ecosystem for mankind and millions of other species. These include biodiversity, climate, ocean acidification, and land use. The book explores the boundaries in each of these systems, beyond which there'd be serious consequences for life on Earth. The God Species in question, of course, is us. Humans, says Lynas, are uniquely important in holding or breaking these boundaries and maintaining the balance of the ecosystem.
My previous book was called 6 Degrees, Our Future on a Hotter Planet, and it mapped out the likely path towards planetary catastrophe if global greenhouse gas emissions are not curtailed. So I suppose I'm very strongly in the camp of climate change being a critically urgent challenge, which we need to pull out all the stops to solve. And you know, I have a history of being both a campaigner and a writer on this this issue, and it's something I've believed in very strongly and worked, hopefully, I think, very hard on for, you know, for the best part of a decade.
So this is not a case of saying we don't need to do anything at all, and just in case anyone sort of decides to pick up on that. Now, you're an environmental campaigner, but the book that you, the new book, God Species, really outlines a plan of action that it goes counter to a lot of what Friends of the Earth, Greenpeace and others might argue is the way to sort of tackle climate change. They will all agree with you that climate change is an issue, we need to do something about it, but their solutions are different. Can you outline what it is you think that the traditional green movement has got wrong?
Well, I think the traditional green movement has got a lot right in terms of raising awareness of just how urgent the climate change situation is, but it's got a lot wrong in terms of foreclosing our options for dealing with it. And my principal objection is the rejection of nuclear power that you hear from the vast majority of the green movement, because nuclear is our primary source of low-carbon electricity around the world, and it needs to be expanded greatly in order to achieve the transformation that we so desperately need towards a low-carbon economy. And you can see what's happening now in Germany, for instance, where they're phasing out nuclear power, and there are plans to build new coal plants and new gas plants as a result. So whilst I'm very enthusiastic and supportive of renewables, I don't think renewables can do the whole job in supplying very large quantities of energy to highly centralised, highly populated industrialised societies, to be honest.
Have you always been pro-nuclear?
I wouldn't say I've always been pro-nuclear. I've never been a sort of, you know, CND supporter, you know, marching against nuclear power. But certainly when confronted with pro-nuclear views in the past, I've always thought they were wrong. So I certainly didn't dream of questioning the environmental orthodoxy on nuclear power until comparatively recently.
And so what was it that made you reassess your views on that?
I simply went back to basics, if you like. I mean, in writing this book, I was looking at the most important planetary scale changes, so-called planetary boundaries, climate change being one, biodiversity being another, and there being nine in total. And if you look at the energy options that we've got, nuclear power actually, if you judge it by the planetary boundaries, is one of the most environmentally friendly options. It doesn't negatively affect biodiversity, it doesn't affect the water cycle, it's a very, very efficient use of land, and so on and so forth. So it seemed to me, actually, that if you do try and have a rational first principles approach to nuclear, there are far more benefits than there are drawbacks, even at the very strict environmental reading of it.
Obviously, the environmental movement goes against that sort of idea. They claim that actually, when it comes to it, the government subsidies for nuclear power are too big, it costs too much, the waste is a problem eventually, and also that even making the fuel rods themselves is hugely carbon intensive. Now, it could be that, you know, many people are sort of 50-50 on nuclear, but clearly you're sort of pro it now. But how do you counteract those sorts of arguments? Are those arguments valid, but climate change is more important, so we have to deal with that? Or do you think that the green movement has got some of the economics wrong?
The arguments you've made, I think, are largely mythological. I mean, we can deal with them in sequence if you like, but there's no doubt that nuclear power is a very low carbon source of generating energy. Waste simply isn't an issue environmentally. And there are new nuclear technologies like fast breeder reactors, which can run off the existing nuclear waste stockpiles and plutonium and so on. So the idea that we're going to run out of uranium isn't really an issue either. And I don't think you can say that the government has been supportive of nuclear, even financially. I mean, it wasn't until 2006 that nuclear was even put back on the table in this country. There haven't been any nuclear power stations built in Europe or in North America for a very long time. And that's because, in my reading of the situation, the tide of public opinion swung very heavily against it. And that was largely led by environmental campaigning back in the 70s and the 80s. So I do think the environmental movement made an enormous historical mistake in coming out against nuclear power. And we're partly suffering the effects of global warming because the environmental movement, the green movement, stopped nuclear being a much bigger energy source in the past.
Now, you say waste isn't a problem environmentally. I mean, it is a problem, though. No one quite knows what to do with it.
Well, the waste of any industry is a problem. I mean, the waste of the aluminium industry or the electronics industry needs to be properly safeguarded, but no one seems to worry about that. So the waste from nuclear power is comparatively small. I mean, in terms of volume, it's tiny, and it's relatively easy to deal with through putting it underground, what's left, and it will become safe in a matter of a few hundreds of years. And it's not particularly toxic compared to so many other wastes we have to deal with. So it's an issue which has been blown out of all proportion, which has some fairly simple technological solutions.
What's the response in the green movement to your arguments on nuclear and nuclear power?
Well, I mean, I think it's fair to say that you can't say the green movement speaks with one voice on this because there is a whole diverging set of opinions, obviously. But by and large, Greens view my position on nuclear as completely heretical. I'm accused of being in the pay of the nuclear lobby. I'm accused of sort of having some psychological problem. I mean, whatever else it happens to be. I mean, so it is. It's very difficult to have a sort of rational first principles debate on this because people have got such long-term established positions. I mean, you know, Greenpeace and Friends of the Earth were both founded largely as anti-nuclear groups. So it's going to be very, very difficult for them to actually challenge their sort of founding principles.
Another one of the big totem pole issues for environmental groups has been genetically modified crops and genetically modified foods. When GM crops first appeared in the UK more than a decade ago, the environmentalists would go in and trash the fields. I mean, that still happens around the world now. Once again, this is something that you think might be a potential useful technology in terms of tackling climate change. Can you explain what you mean by that, and then also, again, why you differ from the traditional Greens on this?
I don't think GM is particularly a big deal in terms of tackling climate change, actually. I think it's probably more useful in terms of land use, nitrogen efficiency, and some other fairly serious environmental challenges, which I consider, and the scientists who I'm working with consider, to be planetary boundaries. And that's what, as I say, what the book's about. But certainly there is simply no substantive scientific evidence at all that GM has any health effects. or any substantial environmental effects. There's no substantiated cases.
Why the sort of vehement anger and opposition in the Green Movement?
Because it's a. I mean, I was involved in setting up the anti-GM movement, and I hope that isn't giving myself too much credit. But I was centrally involved in some of the very early meetings where it was decided that this was going to be a big deal, with Greenpeace and with sort of freelance campaigners like myself. So I'm very, very well aware of all the arguments that were made against it, because I was one of the most outspoken campaigners against GM for a long, long time, and I participated in anti-GM actions. So I know what all the arguments against it are, but I don't think they hold up to scrutiny. And the process for my sort of change of mind on this was trying to hold myself to the same standards on biotechnology as I do on climate change. You know, you can't reject the science and a whole area of biological sciences if you then say everyone else has got to totally respect the science on climate. That just wasn't a sustainable position, because it's so completely contradictory.
Now, what's the likelihood, do you think, of the UK having GM crops in the coming decades? I mean, it's the emotional argument was lost last time round, and it doesn't look like it's going to come along in huge droves. But do you think there's a chance for companies to come in and regrow their sorts of crops all over again? Or do you think that the opposition in this country is too intense?
I really don't know in terms of the wider public opposition. Certainly the environmental movement has made up its mind on this and isn't about to change it. This is being considered at the European level. I mean, the European Parliament had legislation going through on this just last week, where they've basically had to admit that there aren't any scientific reasons. There's no rational reasons to oppose GM anymore. So it's basically an ethical religious issue almost. And the question is whether individual European member states can forbid their farmers from planting GMOs on sort of religious grounds, if you like. And that's the level that it's got to. So the science is basically out of the window. And I think the environmental movement should drop this issue now, because there are, you know, it just doesn't make any sense. There's so many other technologies in terms of improving seeds and improving crop varieties and so on. Maybe Europe can just be a sort of backwater agriculturally, and that's how we're going to be. We're going to be some kind of, sort of like a museum. But certainly biotech offers great potential in Africa and other parts of the world, and that needs to be explored. So I thoroughly welcome the Kenyan government's change of mind on this, and other African governments, I think, will shortly follow suit, because there are so many opportunities for drought-resistant GM crops, for GM crops which are much more efficient in terms of how they use fertilizer, subsistence crops aimed at farmers who need to feed their families and have high nutrition levels and so on and so forth. And it's an enormous shame that the Western environmental movement convinced many NGOs in the what you call the third world, in the developing world, to oppose GM. That was also been a big mistake.
Do you think there's a disconnect between the way that environmentalists sometimes use science? I mean, many of them have been very instrumental in making sure that governments take climate change seriously and done sterling work on that front. But as you say, the rationalism seems to disappear when you're talking about GM or nuclear or other sorts of technologies that could be used to deal with environmental problems.
Yes, that's quite true. And I don't think the Greens would agree with what you say. But certainly the opposition to GM and nuclear is irrational and has no scientific basis and is basically prejudice, Luddite sort of prejudice, anti-technology prejudice. I mean,
is it a case of using science to bolster whatever argument you happen to believe?
Well, it requires cherry picking, and it requires you to behave like a climate skeptic or denier on GM and nuclear. You have to sort of really hold to a very extreme argument on far out blogs and things like that. I mean, there's simply no credibility to the arguments against it. And if anything, I'm ashamed that it took me so long to realise this. To be honest, you know, it is very difficult to change your mind, and you do in the process then get accused of vacillating, or you look weak because you've made a U-turn on things. I've been asked how many more U-turns am I going to do. But, you know, as I think J.M. Keynes was supposed to have said, when the facts change, I change my mind. What do you do, sir?
How are you attempting to build bridges back to your can I say former friends in the environmental movement? What would you recommend to them to come along the same journey that you've done?
Well, I think it's very difficult, because it's got quite personalised. And when you get sort of personal accusations of heresy and so on and betrayal even, It's going to be difficult to rebuild the bridges, but you'd be surprised actually privately how much support I get, even from within the mainstream environmental groups, naming no names obviously. You know, people do send me a lot of emails saying that they think what's in the book is useful, and they sort of privately agree but wouldn't want to say so publicly. And I think also there's a whole constituency out there in the general public who've been very put off by the sort of extremism of the green movement on some of these issues, will be much more open to dealing with climate change and other real environmental challenges more rationally once they see these issues not being completely dominated by the proposals made by the green movement.
Now, your book is called The God Species, the idea being that humans created many of these environmental problems, but also we have the solutions technologically and, you know, philosophically to actually deal with this stuff. How far would you go when it comes to using technology to tackle climate change and other environmental issues like biodiversity, etc.? Did you go so far as to suggest that we need to be testing geoengineering, for example, and those sorts of planet scale things?
I certainly think we need to be going down the road towards much more intensified research on geoengineering options, because it may well be an important sort of insurance policy if we do get much more rapid and intense global warming. But the point of the God species as a sort of metaphor is that humans are so dominant now over the Earth system. We've changed the chemistry of the atmosphere, we've changed the pH of the oceans, we've changed the color of the sky, we've changed completely the biomes on the land, what grows where and so on. And for that reason, the geologists are considering that we have now entered the Anthropocene. We're in a new geological epoch. Things are very different from how they were 10 or even 20 years ago, and we need to rethink our management of the planetary system with that in mind. You know, humans as a species are trying to manage climate change. This is what all these interminable meetings are about in the various COPs of the UNFCCC. There's the same process underway for biodiversity. But issues like land use, freshwater use, nitrogen cycle interference are not considered at a planetary level, and I think that they need to be. So it's not just about the temperature of the globe. That's an important issue, but there's many other ones as well.
Doesn't it risk, though, having the sort of technological solutions or centrally made decisions by the UNFCCC and others, these will be dominated by the very countries that made these problems happen in the first place, the rich West and developing world, China's not a developing country anymore, but those sorts of countries. The vast majority of the world doesn't really get a say in deciding how to tackle this stuff if we're deciding everything centrally.
You'd be surprised, actually, because I've worked as a government negotiator for the Maldives, which is a small island state, one of the most vulnerable countries in the world to sea level rise. And actually, you can have quite a large say in an institution like the UN Framework Convention on Climate Change, because it includes all of the governments. It's not just a powerful, it's not like the UN Security Council. It's far more democratic, if you like, because every country is formally equal, however tiny it is in terms of how much it can punch geopolitically. So you have an equal status with the United States and with China, even as the Maldives in the UNFCCC, and I think actually that's been very valuable.
I mean, are you optimistic that these challenges you raise in your book will be dealt with in time? I mean, a lot of these things, there's not huge amounts of time before many more species go extinct and the temperature of the globe goes up and freshwater resources disappear and people have to move from homes in all over Africa. How much time do we have, and are we going to get there?
Well, actually, the book is a relatively optimistic reading of the situation. I think we need to move away, and this is one of my other gripes with the green movement, is that it is too pessimistic, by and large, in terms of the kind of prognostications it makes about gloom and doom. And I've been very guilty of this in the past, particularly with regard to climate change. We need to emphasize more that practical solutions are out there to deal with pretty much all of these problems, whether they're technical or whether they involve political change or behavioral change or anything else. So we can go forward and solve these problems if we see how they interact. You know, biodiversity interacts with climate change at a very strong level. So we can't address one problem by causing another one. And that's why all nine of these planetary boundaries need to be considered simultaneously.
Mark, thank you very much.
Pleasure.
Thanks to Mark Lynas there. His book, The God Species, is published by Fourth Estate, and it's available at guardianbookshops.co.uk. For more information on Mark and his writing, check out his website, marklynas.org.
And now, the Herford question.
My name is Brian Svitek. I'm author of Written in Stone. And the one question that I would like to have answered by science is, what did dinosaurs smell like? That's kind of a silly question, but if we're able to answer a question like that, that means that we'll have developed paleontology and integrative fossil sciences to the degree that we're able to get a really an excellent picture of what dinosaurs were like during their lives. So even though it's kind of an absurd question, it might not tell us very much about evolution in the big picture. If we're able to answer something like that, then paleontology will have really come of age, I think, as a science.
Now, working out what dinosaurs might have smelled like is probably the kind of question that would turn up at the Royal Society's Summer Science Exhibition. This year's annual Jamboree took place at the start of the month, and in order not to miss out on the great science on display, we sent along intrepid reporter Anna Perman to capture a flavour of this year's event.
The Royal Society Summer Exhibition is full of amazing sights and sounds. What you're hearing right now is the sound of the Northern Lights. This year, the University of Leicester had a stand explaining how listening to one of the most beautiful sights in the universe can show us some serious science. Here's Dr. Carlos Gain explaining to me what causes an aurora borealis.
The aurora is really our window into the magnetosphere. The aurora is created by charged particles that are bound to the Earth's magnetic field lines. And as they flow along those magnetic field lines, they strike the neutral molecules in the atmosphere. And when they strike them, they impart some energy. When they impart some energy, the neutral molecules give that energy back out as light. So really what we're looking at is we're looking at the charged particles hitting the Earth's atmosphere.
So they give out light energy. Do they give out any other kind of energy at all as well?
They do indeed. They give out radio waves. And if we point our antennas in the right direction, we can listen to those radio waves and we can frequency shift them down into the audible range and we can then hear them as sound clips.
So the Earth has an aurora borealis. Do any other planets have aurora borealis as well?
Oh, absolutely. To create aurora, you just need the raw ingredients. You need some charged particles, you need a magnetic field, and you need some neutral atmospheric molecules. Any planet that has those ingredients can create aurora. For example, Saturn and Jupiter and Uranus are some of the planets in our solar system that create aurora. But we can also listen to those same radio waves given out by planets that aren't in our solar system. And of course, we know that if they're creating aurora, then they have magnetic fields. If they have magnetic fields, then we know that they have magnetospheres, which is our protective bubble, which protects us from the solar wind. Now, if these other planets are protected by a magnetosphere, then it's very possible that they can harbor life.
Your marks, get it, go, and they're off. And the bicycle is in the lead, but swiftly followed by...
That's Dr. Andrew Hansen starting off a race to produce electrical energy. He explained to me why the National Physics Laboratory have been looking into how we can use the waste from normal power stations and why they're having a race to find out which is best.
It's dreadful how much energy is lost. A typical generating power station, two-thirds just goes straight out the window as heat. It's really quite awful. It'd be great if we can reclaim some of that energy.
So this is something that takes noise and generates it into electricity. So in theory, could any noise that we make usually be, you know, turned into electricity?
Absolutely. And noise is essentially vibration in this circumstance. So, for example, you could fit these piezoelectric systems underneath a pavement, say a station concourse, and then all of your passengers walking across there in the morning could basically generate lots of electricity, which might go towards reducing the electricity bill of the station. Now, the problem with this is we don't know how efficient these things are. You can only do this if you measure them accurately, and that's why the National Physical Laboratory, who we work for, is involved in this technology. We've got a European project researching the way of measuring efficiency of energy harvesting technologies. If we can make the world a much more efficient way and understand how to measure that efficiency, then we've got a more energy-friendly planet.
And bicycle seems to have completely given up the ghost. She's just exhausted. Oh, she's just limping home now. Limping home now. Oh, wow. It's all over. It's all over.
Yes. In the final stop on my tour around the Royal Society Summer Exhibition, I found some scientists from the University of Bristol who were showing off the future of music technology. Kind of like an iPhone, but the size of a coffee table. Pete, one of the guys helping out, explained to me how it works. That was absolutely amazing, and that was all done by drawing shapes on this fantastic iPhone device. How long have you been practicing that, Pete?
So I've been working on this thing for about 6 months. And I suppose I've been learning to use it over the last week or so.
So the vibrations that you're making, they kind of look like a guitar string, yes, kind of going, but it's a similar sort of principle. You're just using wave frequencies.
Yeah. So the simple example is pretty much exactly the same as a guitar, but we take it a little bit further and imagine building a guitar which is like a complex network of strings. So I can take loads of guitar strings and tie them together in some big complicated network or graph and see how that sounds, and you can get some different sound out of it.
That's absolutely beautiful. Thank you very much, Pete.
Thanks very much.
A big thanks there to Anna Perman. And for more information on the Royal Society's ongoing events and initiatives, visit their handsome website, royalsociety.org. That's all we have for this edition of Science Weekly. You can keep up to speed with breaking science news at any time, of course, on guardian.co.uk/science. But from me, Alok Char, and Science Weekly producer Jason Phipps, it's goodbye for now. Thanks for listening.
For more great downloads, go to guardian.co.uk.